Welcome to the Ed Up Experience Legal Podcast. I'm your host, Deborah Solmar. Today, I'm honored to have as my guest, Charlie Rose, the Dean and Professor of Law at ONU Law. A shout out to my colleague, Lisa Lang, the General Counsel at ONU, for introducing me to Dean Rose. So there's been a lot written of late about the how and the why of legal education. I know when I went to law school all those years ago, my education was based on what we call the Socratic method. Read the cases, show up at class, hope that you're well prepared if you get called on. And if not, you just kind of fake it. And I think today we're looking at many more programs that are aiming to educate our students in a much more practical and experiential way. So I'm excited to have you here today, Dean Rose, to talk about your philosophy and some of the exciting things that you and your team are doing at ONU. So welcome to the podcast.
Glad to be here.
Great. So let's start out with, I guess, the way, you know, most of us, well, many of us were trained in law school. Does the Socratic method work at teaching? Did it ever work?
It works okay for teaching critical thinking, which is one of the foundational skills that you have to have. But it is woefully inadequate to teach you how to actually do what lawyers do on a day-to-day basis. You rely upon critical reasoning, but it's not the thing that consumes your time. So it's a nice entryway into a legal education, but it can't be the sum total, because the higher up the chain you get in the level of complexity of the law, the less useful the Socratic method is.
And I would say when I came out of law school, I worked at a big law firm for many, many years. And I don't think any of my legal education was based on sort of the practicalities of the how to be a lawyer. Where do you think, and when do you think this sort of shift started happening and people started realizing, well, maybe we should be thinking about teaching differently?
Well, if you go back and look into the early 1990s, you look at the McCrate report, you look at the follow-on Carnegie Mellon report, and you look at the growth of skills education, it really started in the 1990s, and it has been picking up speed ever since. And with the impending change to the Uniform Bar Examination, the adoption of the next gen bar, the paradigm will have been almost completely flipped. And you're going to be tested based upon your ability to apply the law using the soft skills that you historically learned primarily after you got into the practice. And so it's a very different world now.
So that would make sense, since without dating myself, or perhaps in spite of dating myself, I graduated from law school in the early 90s. So talk a little bit about this next gen bar. How is the bar exam sort of shifting, and what is the impact of that going to be?
Well, if you think about the bar exam historically tested your ability to memorize information in your short-term memory about a variety of legal subjects. And they picked the sort of the big six or the big seven, and those always showed up. What they're going to do is pivot to, here's the law, now apply it in this situation. And it might be a memorandum. It might be an outline of a negotiation that you want to conduct. It might be structuring a cross-examination of a witness. And the idea is that through the rubric of creating the actual practice of the law in a controlled environment, you'll showcase your understanding of the legal concept. So maybe it's create a cross-examination of the defendant in a criminal case where you're going to use 404B evidence as the prosecutor. And so you've got to understand how to apply that. You've got to understand how to create the question. You have to be able to do things that historically some students learn, but not all students. And now that paradigm is going to be shifted. That's going to be kind of a foundational requirement. That is a sea change, and it's going to require a deep thought about what curriculum looks like, where we spend our money in law school from an educational perspective, and who is best situated to actually deliver that type of education. I would put to you, it is not where you went to law school, and it's not where I went to law school, but in the very near future, it'll be places like where I'm the currently dean, because we are closer to where the rubber meets the road from the practice of law perspective.
So I'd like to sort of talk about some of the great things that you're doing at ONU. But first, I do have to say that listening to you has brought back so many acronyms in my head that I still all these years remember about what I learned for the bar exam. You know, that you can refresh someone's recollection with anything, including a bowl of Mrs. Garibaldi's spaghetti. I remember learning that. And I could give you so many more, but I think your point is well taken. It really was a summer filled with memorization, and then 2 days of a test, and then you just dumped it all.
Well, I've reached that point now where I can remember the acronyms, but I can't remember what it stood for anymore. that's how deeply ingrained that need was in that short, compressed period of time. You're still going to need to understand the law. But that's, you know, if you look at Bloom's taxonomy of education, understanding the law is at the bottom. And then analyzing the law is the next level, then synthesis of the law, and then its application. That we're now trying to get into that piece of it from a testing perspective, which is going to have all sorts of implications for the legal profession. It's going to open the door to folks who historically were not as viable candidates for law schools because of their LSAT scores or their GPA. All of a sudden, those real world skills, if we can sort out how to find them, are going to be much more important when it comes to actual success in law school and the practice of law.
So tell me a little bit about some of the things that you're doing on your campus to ensure that, and it sounds like you've already moved very significantly in that direction towards the more practical and the more experiential, but I'd be interested to sort of dive into a little of that.
Well, Ohio Northern University has a history of being a very practice-focused law school for a long, long time. It's created leaders in communities. It's created prosecutors and public defenders and judges and state representatives and then senators and governors. That's just sort of who we've been from a DNA perspective. It's one of the reasons I was attracted to the school, because I have a foundational belief that when you teach someone how to apply the law, they understand it at a much more, a deeper level. And I'll give you an example. You've played a board game. I'm sure everybody listening to us has played Monopoly or the Game of Life, right? What's the first thing you do when you open up that box? You look at the pieces, you hold them, you move them around, you open up the board, you see what's on the board. We as human beings learn through tactile manipulation, through the application. And then we go to the rules to help us understand how to actually play the game. That's actually where law students perform best, regardless of the LSAT score, regardless of their GPA, is where they go to the rules to empower themselves to be more effective in accomplishing a goal. Well, if you know this from an educational perspective, you start thinking tell, show, and do. You tell them what the law is going to be, you show them how to do it, and then they do it, right? So all of a sudden, a lot of your educational time is spent on the showing and the doing, which is a problems-based case analysis approach to the learning of law, as opposed to a doctrinal substantive-based learning. There's still a place for the doctrinal learning, but that place is smaller than it was 20 years ago. And you can see where this problems-based, case-based approach in the upper-level curriculum, business associations, tax, evidentiary law, has pretty much taken over. And the old doctrinal Socratic method of teaching those classes, it's still around because law professors have tenure and they tend to teach for a very long time, but it's not the rising or ascendant approach. And so you look at that, and I wanted to come to ONU because I wanted to build the type of law school that empowers people to help others. And that's the practice of law. So you increase your trial team competitions, you increase your moot court competitions, you teach students how to use artificial intelligence to level the playing field between the big firm and the small firm and the solo practitioner in a way that is transformative. You look at those things, and then you look at your curriculum and you start thinking about things like modality of delivery. How many classes actually need to be in the building? How many classes could be taught online, allowing students to do other things in the upper level? And then you say, well, maybe some programs should be completely online, so that we can expand access to legal education to folks who can't currently make it work financially, but could make it work financially if they were able to work their job and go to law school. We're in the process of creating a program like that now. So you begin to think about the structural value, and then you think about the type of law professor I need to teach in those sorts of environments and the type of commitment the institution has to have to the value of a practical approach to legal education. It's one of the things that we've historically done really well, and I'm really excited to approach it and to do even more of it. The proof is in the pudding. My students pass the bar exam far beyond the predictive metrics if you look at their LSAT scores or their GPA. And they get jobs and they go on and they lead great lives because we are keeping our eye on the prize of the practice of law and not the theory of law. Theory is wonderful. I can talk about it all day long. Clients don't want to hear theory. Judges don't want to hear theory. The only people who want to hear theory are other law professors or other lawyers.
I think when we were speaking offline, I had mentioned to you that I had, I'm a civil procedure buff. I really like civil procedure. I'm a civil procedure geek, I guess you could say. And I had a professor in law school who always found the most important points in the case footnotes. And when I think about how many times I went before a judge or I wrote in a brief, my major point was based on some footnote in a decision, it would probably be zero. So I think, you know, when you think about that.
Well, we like to dance on the head of a pin as academics, right? We want to argue mm-hmm. about things that don't really matter to anyone but us. That doesn't work when you're practically representing a client. Understanding the structure of the law, mm-hmm. understand the application of the law, the trends of where the law is going or not going, those things are important. The politics of the judge that you're in front of, that's important mm-hmm. because the voice that you need to use to be persuasive. Having the soft skill set to figure all that out is not the same skill set as picking out a footnote that's different from anything else that I can talk about to make me look smart.
Yeah, I think your point is well taken. I think about one of the most practical things I learned as a large firm lawyer was how important local counsel could be and how no matter how excellent I was at my orating skills and my writing skills, I knew that when I was in a jurisdiction far outside the, you know, Chicago, my greatest ally could be somebody there who knows the court, knows the judge, knows the local rules, which ones are enforced, which ones are not. And again, I didn't learn any of that while I was in school.
But imagine if you had, if you combined the deep understanding of the doctrine with the ability to apply it well in an individual situation, you become an extremely effective attorney very earlier in your career. Prior to coming to ONU, I was the director of the advocacy programs at Stetson University College of Law. And my alumni would routinely tell me that the kids who graduated from our program were the equivalent of an associate with 3 to 5 years of experience. Yeah. Because all of the upper level curriculum was devoted to the application of the law in a real world setting.
What do you see about with respect to student engagement, right? It's no secret. Law school is hard. I know they have the moniker. It's the first year they scare you to death. The second year they work you and the third year they bore you. But let's face it, law school was hard then and it's hard now. What are you seeing in student engagement when you're designing programs that are more practical and that, you know, you mentioned increased trial team work, increased moot court. I mean, I would assume that maybe you're seeing a lot more student engagement and interest in the work that they're doing and the learning.
I'll give you an example. I had a young woman who is a rising 3L. She'll be a 3L this year. Last year, she was a 2L. At the end of her first year of law school, she had done okay, but had not excelled in anything. Never been on the dean's list, never experienced that moment where the law really clicked for her. She was on our trial team last year, and she did well. She's got the personality for it. She has the grit, the work ethic for it. I'm signing the certificates for the dean's list this summer. And guess whose name shows up on the dean's list?
Yeah.
That young woman. Why? Because the law came alive for her. I go back and look at the dean's list, and all of a sudden I'm seeing a lot of students who are deeply involved in the application of law. I'm seeing law review kids, moot court kids, trial team kids, and clinical students. Because for all of them, the law became real when they started to apply it. And so there's a power there that engages them, and they will work harder Once they understand the benefit of it, then they will, if it's just the same thing for three miserable years. It has to be challenging because training is only valuable if you are proud of having survived it. Training is only useful if it's sufficiently difficult that you get a sense of accomplishment out of having done it. But it doesn't have to be abusive to be effective. It just has to be stringent, has to be hard.
You talked a little bit about AI, and AI is something every industry, every corner, every other article is about AI in a particular industry or organization. And, you know, I spend my time as a lawyer in the higher education space, and I feel as if higher education is a little bit taking a very cautious approach to AI and is really a little slow at sort of figuring out how to be effective, since it presents a lot of potential challenges in using for admissions, using it for testing. So I'd love to get your thoughts about AI, and we talked a little bit about how you're using it at Ohio Northern, and it would be interesting to talk about some of that with our listeners.
Well, we're using it. We started this last year using it to create assignments where we want to teach the law student how to effectively use the resource, just like any other tool, right? So we assigned them in certain classes, some of their problems required them to use artificial intelligence to generate a first draft. And then we taught them how to read critically that piece created by artificial intelligence and, quite frankly, created by the student. Because the artificial intelligence only responds to the quality of the prompt written by the person using it. So the ability to ask cogent, intelligent, structured, articulate questions is extremely important, right? So what we saw immediately was understanding how to identify the legal issue and then ask questions to get to the process that you need to come to a good answer was paramount. It's convinced me that we need to embed artificial intelligence across the curriculum from a teaching perspective. I'm not saying that it takes the place of teaching. I'm saying that it's a tool that teachers can use. I'm doing an evidence seminar this fall, and I'm going to start out the first day of class. I'm going to pull ChatGPT-4 up on the board, and I'm going to type a query into it with input from the students, and then we're going to see what it tells us. And then we're going to talk about how do we use this tool ethically and responsibly, because it's both remarkably threatening and giving us remarkable opportunity. Because if you think about the young lawyer in a public aid office who doesn't have enough resources, who doesn't have enough time and has overwhelming need, how might the effective use of artificial intelligence change the impact that he or she could have on their clients?
And do you feel among your peers that's a sort of a common approach, or do you think you're sort of an outlier in where you're taking AI?
I think already? I'm probably ahead of most because I've historically built my career on early adoption of technology and leveraging before other people did, going all the way back to the 1980s. So I see the way forward, right? In 5 years, if your law school doesn't have a vibrant plan to address artificial intelligence, you're not going to provide an education that the student can actually use. Because the expectation in big law firms in particular, and in government and in general counsel jobs, is that you're going to use artificial intelligence to check what you're doing constantly. And it's going to pivot very quickly. It's not going to go away.
And I think, you know, sort of as a GC, I think to myself, when I see this technology, even if I wanted to, or I thought it were prudent, trying to get people to not use it is not an option. So it's sort of the next step is, how do I use my legal skills? How do I use my role to ensure that we're using it in a responsible, efficient, and effective manner?
I mean, if you look at it, in 5 years, if a law school is not teaching law students how to use this tool effectively, they're not going to be producing lawyers who can work in the legal community. I'm at a conference out here in Denver this week. They just told us that the number one industry that they think is going to be impacted by artificial intelligence after the latest upgrade to ChatGPT-4 is the delivery of legal services. They are suggesting that maybe 44% of legal services will be accomplished or capable of being accomplished by artificial intelligence. So we need to be thinking about that now. We need to be playing with it now. We need to be using it now so that our students are ahead of the curve and not behind the curve.
Did they give examples of what parts of the legal services they are thinking about?
I just watched ChatGPT write an outline for a deposition.
Oh, wow.
I just saw ChatGPT create a document for a lawsuit with a follow-on set of interrogatories. Now, was it perfect? No. But was it more than sufficient for a first draft to begin thinking? Yes. As I was watching, I started thinking, oh my Lord, I've posted a lot of things on the internet over the years about these skill stuff. I wonder if this robot has read my stuff. It was a very sobering moment, right? A very sobering moment.
Yeah. And as someone who actually drafted discovery in my law firm days, and now as an in-house lawyer and as a GC, pays for other people to draft my discovery. When you think about it, there's a lot of time spent by young lawyers learning the tools of litigation. And one of the ways they learn it is by being asked to draft interrogatories.
So how are they going to learn the tools of litigation
if
they don't get to do that anymore because the robot does it? The answer is they learn it in law school or they don't learn it.
Right. And I think your point is, you have to be able to be sufficiently trained to have a gut check to say this draft interrogatories are good, but I can make them better. I can bring some skills to the table that enhance them. That's really going to get us the information that we want.
I think you want artificial intelligence to work for you and not the other way around.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Shifting topics a little bit, one of the things that fascinated me when we talked offline, and I know there are people who say, don't talk about what you talked about offline, only talk about it online. But we talked about your perspective of a shortage of lawyers. And when you started the conversation, I thought to myself, interesting, I just helped build an osteopathic medical school in Kansas where there is a significant shortage of physicians. I'm very familiar with the conversation about the shortage of doctors. I'm not so much, familiar with a serious conversation about there aren't enough lawyers. And so I really wanted to sort of dive into that with you because I know you're located in a rural area. You have, residents surrounding the college that have very specific legal needs that may not be what are being focused on in traditional schools. So talk a little bit about how you're approaching this idea of that there actually is a shortage of lawyers out there.
Well, there is a shortage of lawyers for a variety of reasons. One is the retirement of the baby boom generation over the next 10 years. Another one is just the desire to be in an urban setting, right? We looked at Ohio. I think 55 counties are in the red. They don't have enough lawyers to deliver basic legal services. If you look at most counties in the Midwest, you're in exactly the same situation. The same goes for the Deep South and the West. We actually don't have enough lawyers in a rural setting to effectively deliver legal services. And we know that the delivery of representation is the way you ensure the existence of a democratic republic. And we've now got swaths of the United States that don't have access to lawyers, doctors, accountants, many of the professional service industry. So how are we going to do that? How are we going to make that work? Well, at ONU, we have some rural lawyering initiatives. I'm on the Ohio State Bar Association's task force for how to solve this problem because it's multi-layered and it's multiphasic, and it has to be done for the good of the nation and the country. But it's also a way to level the playing field for folks who would like to go to law school, but who are in a location where it's almost impossible. And so we're leaning deeply into online education. We're moving towards an online JD degree that we're going to get approved by the American Bar Association. Why? Because this need for access to justice, this need to reach the people who are in those areas and provide them that opportunity, that can be resolved, and it can be resolved with technology. But you've got to have thought about it. You've got to thought about it deeply. And you have to understand, what does the curriculum look like? What is the modality of delivery? What type of internet service do folks in those locations have? How do you make it work? We'll be there when a farmer can work in his field all day long and then come home and boot up his computer and do his torch class. And that will happen because the world is going to require it to happen. And my job is to make certain that that educational experience is as good as or superior to the one that you have in person. And if you're building it around the practice of law, you can make that work.
Oh, I admire your ambitions, and I certainly look forward to continuing to keep in touch and seeing what happens next. I know you've been at a conference all week long. I thank you for making the time to chat with me. And, you know, this has been fascinating. Obviously, I love higher education, but, you know, I'll always have a soft spot for, you know, how people are learning to become lawyers, a profession that all these years later, I still just love doing every day.
It is the profession that built the nation. And it is the profession that has safeguarded freedom for democracies for the last 200-300 years. It's the most sacred thing we do.
I will raise my glass to that. So thank you for taking the time. Enjoy the rest of your conference.
Take care.
Okay, take care.
All right. Bye-bye.